Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Ancient Warfare Podcast. My name is Jos Portas. I'm the editor of the magazine, and with me tonight are Lindsay Powell, Murray Dahm, Mark McCaffrey, Michael Cole, Mark DeSantis, and me. Well, obviously, I'm with me. I'm sorry. I'm a little flustered because Murray was vividly explaining how ancient warfare and opera intersect in him. And in life. So you'll have to forgive us if we're slightly distracted.
I have that effect on people when I sing.
I'm sure we'll manage to get on track in some way. The subject for today's episode is the latest issue, issue 15.1, which deals with special operations in the ancient world. And Murray, just to get you off of opera as well, can you give us the elevator pitch of what we might be talking about?
Well, special operations in the ancient world is one we wanted to make distinguishing from special forces. So special operations, any operation that was slightly out of the norm, that required a special skill set, or that was not quite within what we would normally consider the operations of a standard military unit. So, ambushes and... Obviously, we've got the Batavian swimming as being a sort of a national trait. But the idea originally was that you would have these forces that did these things, whether they were just selected to do them originally or because it was that was the thing they did. But it's one that evolves into special forces in the sense that it would seem originally these operations, whether it be running a siege or, involving combined arms and things like that, was done by normal troops selected for whatever reason. And then slowly over time, that evolves into a unit that becomes associated with doing those things. So that sort of distinction is really interesting because you've got these battles throughout ancient history where they don't run the normal course of battle, that they are involving troops who are required to scale the Sogdian Rock, for instance, or, operate an ambush or run supplies to a siege. So they're very much outside the norm of what we would consider warfare, but they're also required. And of course, then you get the problem of, well, you do what's required in warfare. And when we look at, Trajan's column, you see Roman legionaries and Roman auxiliaries doing everything that's required, whether it be road building, whether it be bridge building, all the way through to demolishing and fighting. So in many ways, the distinction is a modern one where special operations for us are special, whereas perhaps an ancient soldier would go, well, no, we do what's required and some of us are just better at it than others. So that sort of idea of selection of troops or asking for volunteers of troops is a special operation originally, but that's very quickly evolves into a special force. And of course, that brings up all sorts of modern parallels with special forces. But we wanted to look at what some of these original special operations are that would be sort of, from our consideration, sort of outside the norm.
So the Greek epilektikoi, select pick troops. So, first Mantinea, Murray, I'm always going to drag this back into classical Greece if I'm allowed. This is an Argives who have been picked. We're going to crack that unit, right? We're going to go up to the Spartiatae and break them in half. That is a battlefield role, right? And it's certainly performed by regular elements of the phalanx, but we know in this case, because of the Greek, they're specially selected for this op. Does this count, or are we?
Well, the problem with the specially, so I mean, in that case, it's 1,000 Argives that are specially selected. And you look at a lot of other ancient Greek battles. So you've got three. I can't remember the third one off the top of my head. So you've got epilektoi, you've got logades as well. So you've got chosen and picked, which interestingly in English is always interchangeable. You're like, well, maybe logades and epilektoi is different, but it's always one's picked, one's chosen. They're like, no, they're different. And that happens over, Brasidas logades. So he chooses his 150 hoplites who are to break the Athenian phalanx at the Battle of Amphipolis. So it's 150 in that case at First Mantinea. It's 1,000 Argives who break through the gap and do that. And then various different other points, you've got numbers of troops selected. And, you know, in the Theban battles, when you don't get the mention of the Sacred Band, and the Sacred Band's first mention in literary sources is 323, which is, you know, 15 years after it's destroyed in a speech by Dinarches. So in Diodorus, you know, A, Xenophon doesn't mention them at all. B, when you get Diodorus mention them, he doesn't use the term heros locos. He uses epilectoi. So they're selected men. And so that idea of specially selecting someone, but then, you know, even with the Sacred Band, it's like, well, what is their role? We get an anecdote from Thucydides saying that they're the front rank, the 300 charioteers and footmen are the front rank of the Battle of Delium. You know, like, is it a front rank? Is that a special role, or is that just a role? It's weird, isn't it? Because it's the stat. Well, surely breaking the enemy is what any member of a phalanx is trying to do, and yet this 1,000 Argives they're there to do it because weirdly they're next to the 5,000 Argives. So there's like a special unit of Argives. To their left in the phalanx at Mantinea is the rest of the Argives. Then you get the Olenians and Cleonians, and then the Athenians are on the left flank. So it's a really interesting idea of, well, when is a special selection or a special op not a special op, or the opposite.
Well, it's a forlorn hope, right? It's the ancient equivalent of the 16th century or Tudor notion of a forlorn hope, right? You're highly likely to take casualties. You have a special job to do. By the way, the special job is the same as a normal job, but we know you're going to get it done. So I'm just, you know, I don't want to, I've already derailed things like I always do, but I just want to know if that falls under the category, because it's something that's fascinating.
I think the special op in that regards is, are the people who are selected better at doing it for whatever reason? You know, and we get the idea of the Sacred Band, for instance, you know, we can derail it by talking about the Spartans and whether they're better.
I was about to say hoplite, you know, if we take Herodotus at his word, fathers with sons, right? Living
yeah,
sons.
Yeah. But the idea that they're trained full time, so they're better at these maneuvers than amateur hoplites are done, you know, that kind of is a very, but you know, when you look at there are several cities, the Argos being one, but also Elis, Orchomenus, Thebes, obviously, they have these units that they seem to train full-time on public expense. So the idea that they're better at doing the things that everyone's expected to do, you know, they're kind of like the Olympic athletes versus the amateur athletes. The interesting thing is where we've got evidence, a lot of them do indeed have Olympic champions in their ranks. So it's almost an idea of, you want to be like us, you know, you're going to all, you know, even your average hoplite wants to be like the elite unit of their city, because that contains their Olympic champions. It contains the figures of prominence. And if you can be in that elite group, that member of one of only 300, for instance, in some cases, of course you're going to be one of the city's most celebrated hoplites. Not like the rest of you who are hoplites, but we don't celebrate you as much because you're in the, you know, you're in the 10th rank.
Which,
yeah. So yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. So it's a, you know, with the cemetery at Athens. Yeah, they celebrate all their dead. So it's kind of like they're specially selected at the end of their service, not necessarily at the start.
Alexander's attack on the Sogdian Rock in 327 would seem to fit the bill of taking troops who had prior experience. It says Arian says that they had. They called for men who had previous experience in climbing during his sieges. So
that article, there's an article about that particular event in the issue. Of course, it's what Murray said. We're trying to focus. We tried to focus on what they do, because figuring out who exactly does it. I mean, yeah, in the example of Arian, we do know that they were specially picked, but that's not always the case.
Mark, to your question to your point on the Sogdian Rock and mountaineering, I'm pretty sure there's a lot of reference to, like, they were picked, these Illyrians, these Thracians, because they were mountaineers. They put the Phocians up on Calidromos because they were mountaineers. I've seen that so much that I start to think, is this a trope you know, like an othering aspect. Anytime I see something repeated in the sources with such frequency across so many periods, I don't know, Mark, if you'd seen that, if that rang a bell to you.
The explanation that I would go to generally for that would be that Alexander seemed to, when he was conducting anything besides a set piece battle, he tended to leave the phalanx behind and take his cavalry and light infantry units with him, such as the Agrianians, the Paeonians. And those were the troops that he favored for the fast, hard-hitting missions over rough ground, anything that had to cover a lot of territory quickly. So maybe what you're also seeing is something similar. That is, they're lighter troops, they're faster moving, and therefore they would be better suited for the kind of warfare that Alexander was fighting, as opposed to when he went into the big battles with his phalanx, where you actually had a large, a huge enemy army to destroy.
Going with what Mike's saying there, I mean, you mentioned the Agrianians. I mean, it is that sort of that distinction between Macedonians here, between the upper and lower Macedonians as such, sort of, I think, coming through our sources. And that whole, they've got experience in mountaineering. They've also got experience of herding goats and whatnot. It's that little distinction between the less polished and the more, that, this is where our grunts are going to come forward and actually show a bit of, something special.
They're good enough. They're good enough if you need somebody to climb a rock.
Exactly.
Well, it's also interesting, like at Cunaxa or the retreat of the 10,000, you've got the Rhodians and the Cretans. They're not there as Rhodian slingers or Cretan archers. They're there as, we think, depending on the source, that the Rhodians are there as hoplites. And so it's their ability to sling as, it's a national trait that they're good at slinging. According to one of the sources, the Cretan archers are there as Cretan archers. And Cretan archers is a fascinating exploration of this, because the Cretans are supposedly really good at running over rough ground. And that's exactly what they used in the later successors. And again, like Mark was saying, the Cretan archers are often chosen with the Illyrians and the Agrianians and Thracian Peltasts to go and do, take the heights at the Battle of Issus, for instance. And also dodgy stuff. Like, there's a couple of anecdotes of, Alexander wanted this guy tortured, so he let some Cretans do it. You're like, what? And Polybius is fascinating on the Cretans, because he just dismisses them as being dodgy and untrustworthy, but they're clearly and there's several later assassination attempts. Nabis and several others use Cretans to assassinate their political enemies. Cretans, specifically Cretans. And of course, they end up doing it with archery. And so the whole idea in the sources is you can say Cretan and everyone will understand archer. And weirdly, you can also say the opposite. You can say archer and everyone will understand Cretan, even though Cretans aren't necessarily mentioned. And there are other archers around, but Cretans just become associated.
Just to come back to the Sogdian Rock, Alexander is actually asking for volunteers by offering them money. And it specifically says the Macedonians. So this is not like, finding some specific type of troop that is good at mountain climbing. This is people who are apparently actually good at mountain climbing, which is a different way to find out.
The first time they're mentioned is in the Messenian War, whether we trust that or not, not sure. And all the way through to Cretan cohorts of Roman archers that we know until the 3rd century.
I would like to point out the one mention of them in the Messenian War is Pausanias. And we all know the problems of that Hellenistic source, but he does mention they didn't fight. They and the cavalry sat out of that battle. So for whatever that's worth. But it's interesting. I suspect, that it's a backward look. Like, he is a Hellenistic person, has grown up equating the Cretans with that level of fame, and he's kind of projecting it backwards. All the archers were there. They must have been Cretans.
So what I'm hearing all this conversation is that we sort of, making a differentiation between special operations and the people who actually do the special operations. And we spent a lot of time talking about the people doing the special operations right now. It just seems to me that at some point, those things don't become special operations anymore. It's just part of the combat doctrine, which I think was in the theme to the magazine. Because very hard to – there's a point in time probably where you perfect a particular way of fighting. And then someone says, these new terrain or this conditions require a different solution. And then you've got to find somebody like those people you mentioned before. Go take that hill, right? Our guys are too heavily armored. Who can do this? Oh, I know some villagers who are very good at climbing hills, and they're going to be a special operation.
And then weirdly, you get the unit selected and the special force who most of the time, you know, if you think of the Praetorians and others, end up not doing anything particularly special other than, and you know, like when you look at the Greek, the companion cavalry, well, they are heavy cavalry. And whether we think that originally they were doing a special operation, it actually comes down to, no, they're just closer to the king. So
yeah, but that's nomenclature that it's changed by Alexander and Philip because it's something or it originally meant something, but then he extends it to the infantry and then he has to reinforce it with the cavalry before the Persian expedition starts. So by the time we get to Persia, it really doesn't mean much.
But it almost sounds like the specialty then marks them out as being an elite. So in the same way that we in modern parlance, when we talk about special operations, I think of an elite.
Whether you agree that they're the immortals or the apple bearers or whether there's a force or whatever, the Persian immortal 10,000, they're not trained any different. They're more lavishly, you know, they have bling and the earrings, which we know from the reliefs, but they're trained the same as any other soldier. And like the hypaspists, it's people from the normal ranks who are promoted because of service to those ranks. So they're not any different. They aren't trained any differently.
Shouldn't we be saying perhaps favorites in, you know, under some commanders? I mean, I think of, you know, well, if you go to Caesar in his 10th Legion, I mean, you know, he takes the 10th Legion and he decides, I've got a particular job. I can't trust anybody else. So I'll shove you on horseback and you can do the job because I trust you. So you're my, it's sort of special forces, but it's actually them because not necessarily they're trained any better. It's just they're his favorite.
Well, I think nepotism in ancient warfare is a different issue of the magazine. But you're right. You're right. I think it is that they're favorites, but it's like special forces, elites makes much more. Oh yeah. As opposed to favorites.
I mean, Murray, you mentioned the like apple bearers and other, like Royal Guards. I mean, I think originally Royal Guards units, those are the ones that the king could afford to pay 24/7. And then the rest of the army is the militia that is called up. And then later on in the ancient world, you get different armies where you might have more professional troops and there might be a different distinguishing feature. I think originally it's just, yeah, it's pay and status that makes them.
It's interesting. Like when we go back to issue 14.6 and you look at the Battle of Waoush, the Royal Guard accompany the king in the front rank to break the enemy and the levy follow. So it is that you are doing the job at the front. You know, even Alexander's companions, they're the hammer to the anvil of the phallus.
Yeah, but by the time the Praetorian Guard.
Oh yeah, so by much. The exactly. It's like, and there's even evidence that people say that they're not actually very good at fighting the Praetorian Guard. And when you look at the custodes, the Octavian's Germanic, you know, these are specially selected Germanic, Batavian and others to be a guard who were then dismissed by Galba. And then you sort of get this evolution of, well, who is the favorite? But they're not especially skilled. They're just paid more than anyone else. And so, of course, everyone wants to get promoted to them. But it's like, yeah, but their actual battlefield role isn't elite anymore. It's not a special operation or a special force.
They seem to actually be almost like a pure Italian sourced group of people. I think there's a lot of equestrians or something like that in them. And they're all encamped in Italy or in Rome, finally.
It's in the Greek, hetairoi, right? You know, pes hetairoi, the foot companions, like that is their linkage to the monarch that the status applies to. And I certainly understand that when you're dealing with a 16,000 man phalanx, every single one of them is not good friends with Alexander, but the naming convention speaks to the existence of that relationship rather than an elite status as a fighter as the relevant role.
Yeah, it's also interesting that, you know, with the phalanx, you've got the front rankers are your best troops. We've got that mentioned. Your second best fighters are your rear rank troops. You know, they're the ones who are keeping everyone there. If they have to do a counter march or, you know, they're the second bank. So you've almost got that promotional idea within it that you want to go, like in the Roman Centurion. You want to go to, you want to be promoted to an Optio. You want to be promoted to a Centurion, even if it's the most junior Centurion. Then as a Centurion, you want to achieve a Primus Pilus or a Camp Prefect and all that sort of stuff with promotion. And I think even in the Phalanx, and this comes back to the Sogdian Rock, that reward of, I think it's 500 drachma for the first across the wall, 300 for the second, and so on. That kind of reward is a status symbol within, you know, and again, when you come to the Romans, they've got these corona and these phalera that are awards for bravery. So there is a, bizarrely, a marking out of someone as elite, even within a normal unit. And we get celebrations of all of these corona civica and things like that, that are achieved within normal ranks of troops. But somehow that achievement ranks them out as elite as well. And as Lindsay was saying, then it becomes, oh, well, those guys are good at doing that. Let's send them over the wall first. And then it becomes a status that this is our role. We go first. We always go first. And even going back to Plataea, you know, there's the argument with the Athenians. So the understanding at the Plataea is, well, the Spartans are going to take the right flank. That's the honor of position, and they get that regardless of whether we want it or not. But then there's an argument between the Tegeans and the Athenians about who gets the honor and the right to hold the left flank of the army. And so it's like, well, we deserve it more because we've always held it whenever there's been an allied army with the Spartans. And then the Athenians say, well, we fought Marathon. And then the Spartans say, oh, okay, no arguments. You fought Marathon. You get to have the left. But the Tegeans, we'll let you fight right next to us on the right flank because, you know, we'll give you that honor. And interestingly, when we know they're right next to the Spartans at the Battle of First Mantinea in 418, and they're right next to the Spartans at the Battle of Nemea in 394. So that you know, is that just a favor? Is that nepotism? Or is it, well, the Tegeans are the second most honorable Peloponnesian state, therefore we always used to put them on the left, but now we'll put them right next to us. So it's the same sort of thing. They're special force / elite because of proximity to the Spartans.
Yeah, and you're also getting into the whole psychology thing, which we just did an Ancient Warfare Answers about. I mean, that's always, and of course, elite troops are still distinguished in, you know, by insignia and, you know, maybe beret color, stuff like that.
What about a special operation that's undertaken by the entirety of the army? I'm thinking of the Hydaspes River crossing that by Alexander in the spring of 326, where that was one of his most complicated operations that he ever mounted. That Porus and his army was defending the other side of the bank, wouldn't let him across. And Alexander had to first fix him in place, lull him into believing that, you know, he was not going to be, you know, crossing when he actually was. He marched north many miles, managed to cross at night, got onto the other side of the Hydaspes with a very large proportion of his army. And that was just a remarkable affair. I mean, if that wasn't a special operation, I don't think anything is. And that was the entirety of the Macedonian army.
Speaking of that, as an example from a crossing, is the Gauls crossing the Spercheios at the, I think, sixth battle of Thermopylae in 279 BC, which Pausanias relates. You have specially selected because they're the tallest and they can swim. And then you have a corps that's getting across on their national shields. That's the best translation I can give you. These kind of like Gaulish, I guess you would think of it as a Thoreos that they're using to get across. But it's very clear that there's a specially selected portion because they figure they can get across the water without drowning. It's not an elite troop. You know, it's just like, and they do manage to force the crossing and push the Greeks back into the pass.
It also seems that the Macedonians had a habit of taking their tents, their leather tents, stuffing them with hay and then sewing them up and using them as floats. And that you could actually float a horse on some of these things with a raft. Or presumably you would put the floats below.
That's the same kind of thing that you see on Assyrian reliefs. It's a very old, well, trick, isn't that the word, maybe?
So I was going to suggest this. So if the discussion is really about special operations, that the Roman approach to this was to use the vexillatio, right? What you would do is you would assemble units together. Hear me out. So, for example, in the case of the Bar Kokhba, which I've just finished writing about, for example, there were only about three full legions deployed. There were two actually in Judea, and one was brought in, I think, from Arabia Petraea. And every other legion was basically of exilation. So there are maybe one, two, three cohorts or so on. And it's actually called Expeditio Judaea or Adiaca, which implies it's not a bellum, it's not a war. And it's a tumultum. It's not a revolt. It's an expeditio. It's something different, special. And what you have is you actually have someone in charge of the expeditio. There's a guy that we know that was in charge of it. And you know, presumably they are deployed across the battle theater, right? And they will use whatever techniques. And what's very interesting is that as you chart the war, the traditional battle doctrine, which was to try and fight them in the open field, that doesn't work. Along comes Julius Severus into the discussion. And he realizes the only way we're going to fight a guerrilla war is to act more like small mobile armies and actually going attacking their settlements and their underground caves and so on and so forth. So ironically, he uses the mindset of a special operations guy to adapt it to the new theater of war. And in the end, he wins. And I think it was only possible because you had the flexibility of the commanders thinking, but they also had vexillations. In other words, they were able to, you know, use this group and combine it with that. In fact, we know that in the final siege of Betal, two vexillations from two separate units were partnered up together and actually deployed, and they did the actual siege. And then behind them were arrayed, literally, there were fortresses in there, like a series of arcs behind that. And presumably they had specialties. Added to which, Julius Severus actually brought with him centurions from Britain, because he was, in fact, the governor of Britain. And what's intriguing to me is why those men? And I can only hypothesize that there was a revolt in Britain under Hadrian around about the same sort of time, maybe up for 3-4 years earlier. And he had seen these men in operation. And he would say, you know what? I need your skill sets. You're coming with me. Hadrian's ordered me to Judea. You're coming. And these guys go to Judea and they get deployed amongst other legions. In fact, we know from their tombstones where they went. And in the end, they went back to Britain, most of them. And it's really interesting how they were used for presumably special insights or operations.
That's a fascinating observation that you made concerning the use of the word expeditio. If you could build upon that, I'm wondering, I believe that that was the terminology used for Septimius Severus's imperial expeditions north of Hadrian as well, that he stationed himself at York and then mounted two expeditions in the 190s or 180s, the 190s, or somewhere around there. Now, What would an expedition be in that case as opposed to a war? Is it a gigantic raid, or what would you say about that? And is it really a special hard operation?
You know, we've had conversations like this before. I mean, Latin, Greek, I can't speak to, but the Latin speakers are notoriously imprecise. All right. So we have the written sources in the Tacitus and so on. Of course, we have the Greek version in Cassius Dio. These words tend to appear in the inscriptions. So when you look at a particular commander, he will be Imperator something, something, Expeditio Judaica, for example. And you can extrapolate from that all sorts of things. But the point is, what I like is the fact that the inscription on a tombstone or a monument is local. That's the term the local people use, the local military use to describe what they just did.
That's probably the official messaging.
Well, it could well be. Yeah, it could well be.
And that means it has, you know, when it's Romans, you always, as you well know, you have to be very careful. How does Hadrian want this war to be presented? But it's interesting what you mentioned about the centurions, Lindsay, because that's just because it's well known. The Batavian Revolt, Tacitus mentions that there's a centurion who comes in, is Aquilius from the Balkans, is brought here. And in Nijmegen, there is actually a medallion. It's a big old silver coin, about three inches across, that mentions him. So he's, you know, it's one of those few cases where a text and an archaeological piece of evidence seem to match, at least. And the suggestion there is too that you get somebody who has some idea of, you know, there's trouble brewing in the area, and you get somebody who has some idea of what's going on, and you get a specialist, which says all kinds of interesting things about who knows this. I mean, clearly in your case, the provincial governor maybe, or somebody below him who worked there,
Well, what's interesting, so for example, one of these comes from Deva, which is Chester, for the fans now. So there's this guy called Albius Felix, for example. What was interesting is he was actually an adjutant to a prefect, a Cornicularius Praefecti Praetorio. They love their big man names, don't they? And he was promoted up rather than through appointment by direct commission to become a prima pilis, interesting enough.
That's an enormous jump.
Well, so he has some special talent, right? Maybe. Another guy who's got this wonderful name of Ligustinius Desertus, which apparently means eloquent or fluent. She served in Rome and then got transferred to Britain. And then, in fact, there's a final one here whose another name is Titus Quintius Petrullus, as described from Domo Britannia, which is actually from Britain, and actually served with Three Cyrenaica. And he actually died at 30 in the camp at Bostra. So we talked about centurions in previous podcasts and their mobility, relatively speaking. But we've talked about how that there must have been some kind of, I don't know, like a network or a club or something, so that people knew, hey, you need Albius. Albius is your guy for this. Oh, you need Desertus, because he's much better at these things. And it's just fascinating. So for special ops, knowing who these people are and their talents is crucial, right?
If I can play Lindsay Powell for this moment and do an alternative interpretation, I think you find in some earlier scholars on that war the opposite interpretation, that these centurions are taken with the governor not because of their special ability, because they need to be watched, because they're somehow related to the revolt in Britain. So they're taken away from their armies in Britain. They're then brought to Judea, and then they're split up and put to separate places so that they're not all together and conspiring, which could absolutely be the absolute wrong interpretation. But there's that interesting one, especially when revolts and new imperial come to power, that idea that there's always a revolt, and keeping the ringleaders away from their revolting troops is always an interesting.
Yeah. I probably fall on the side of that these came to his attention for reasons we don't know, because it's not preserved in the inscriptions. And the fact that they get assigned to different units. I mean, you've got to remember, and this is the trouble, when you have these special operations, if you think of the Barkhatov War as being one of those, is that the vexillations are coming from about five, six different kind of provinces, and they're either headed by their Legatus Augusti pro praetore or some designate that's been put in charge. There is no obvious command structure. I mean, is Tinius Rufus, the governor of the province of Judea, the guy in charge? Apparently not, because Julius Severus has been pulled in there by Hadrian. So who answers to who? Because they're both consular in rank, right? And what does the cascading structure look like? And somehow a man like Julius Severus needs to have trusted, we go back to the trusted bit again, right? That would then deploy some people he knows amongst the other legions, keep an eye on them. I want misses every other week. Tell me what's going on. Because, you know, these guys, I don't know the guy from Mysia. I don't know the guy from Pannonia. I need you guys to keep an eye on these people for me.
The guy you mentioned who was Cornicularius and then promoted in one jump to Primus Pilus, that is a very strong suggestion that somebody who knows something useful, that's not promoting away. That is promoting somebody from, you know, in the modern army from, I don't know, an administrative senior NCO rank.
Jasper, are you implying that he didn't earn it? Are you implying that it's not a merit-based promotion?
I'm saying that this is not somebody you're trying to get rid of. This is somebody you're trying to who knows, maybe, you know, who's thought to be essential for a certain task, and you put him high up in the hierarchy so he can actually get people, you know, get to talking to other people on their level.
That or else he knows the wrong kind of information about his commander, and that was reward.
but this is the fun thing about trying to unpick these Gordian knots, where we don't have enough information. And we know that there are operational considerations. I mean, ultimately, these things have to fulfill a mission. They have to work, achieve a goal. But how they make it work in practice, it's a mystery to us, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting what you say about vexillations there, because, of course, in 69... Vespasian sends vexillations of five legions back to Rome with Mucianus and Domitian. So, you know, there's And we wouldn't think that those are specially selected to fight a civil war. Probably not something you would want to claim if you were of Vexillation. But they're, you know, troops enough are left in Judea, and then these other Vexillations march back to Bedriacum. I think it
in the second century especially becomes very much sort of, seems to become policy to not send entire legions anymore, but pretty much always Vexillations, and it's usually explained as in, you know, you don't want to remove the entire legion from an area because it makes it too attractive for the locals to get uppity. Plus, you gather, I don't know how many legions in one province, and then you get a local governor who gets ideas that you don't want him to get. So what you do, you just grab a bit from everyone, and you know, so it's not too powerful, but powerful enough to get the job done.
And what's interesting is it then probably brings in the role of the tribune to the fore, because as I understand it, I think, you know, roughly two cohorts is given to one tribune, who's a very young guy. Like, he's like in his late teens, isn't he, for the most part? When I was researching Germanicus and his expeditions into Germany in AD 14, what he does, he has obviously had to face down a mutiny. And one of the things he works on quickly is that, you know, we need to get their hands covered in blood for a while to get them back into the spirit of fighting, not mutinying. And he takes Vexillations from different units and actually sends them across to the, you know, beat up the Catti or something. And it's a tribune that's in charge of that. We know because there's a description.
But by the second century, tribune is not that young. I think he would have been a prefect first, I think.
Well, we're talking AD 14. So it's still quite early.
I'm just thinking of second century.
I don't know if you may already know this, Lindsay, but that's not that different from the modern military, right? Like, so you're a second, it's just there's two tiers too. If you're a second lieutenant straight out of academy, you're, what are you, 21 years old? And you're a platoon leader. So you definitely have, certainly not as large a span of control as a tribune is going to have. But the point is that tradition of having very young, but socially elevated people, right? You're a college grad, you went through academy, you're slated for big things, you know, in taking an early command. That's definitely something that persists even to this day. You may have already known that.
Well, no, but that's a great insight. It's interesting to have those things affirmed in the modern. So for example, there's more and more evidence that centurions were typically equestrians. And of course, a tribune was an equestrian. So these guys are from the same class, right? So there's no looking down your plebeian that worked your way up through the ranks here. It just must have been rather annoying if you're a long-serving centurion to know that every damn year, every 3 years, whatever it is, you're going to get these young, wet behind the ears guys coming through.
So this dynamic you've just described, Lindsay, is every non-commissioned officer in the United States military. In fact, when you're a company, you hear the complaint, oh my God, here comes another butter bar, meaning the butter bar is the lowest rank. But the biggest compliment when I was a Coast Guard officer that every single junior officer wants is for a senior non-commissioned officer to say, you would have made a good chief, sir, or in the army, you would have made a good sergeant. Like, when you hear that, then you know you're a good officer.
It's every Vietnam movie you've ever seen as well. The idea that the lieutenants were young 21-year-olds and it was their sergeants, you know, whether you've, you know, and again, I think one of the issues we've got is we take that modern, which way round is it? Is that the tribune and your centurions? It looks very similar to it. It's very similar to the 19th century British model, where your sergeant majors are your backbone and your officers are class chosen commissions, not skill.
The camp prefect has that role in the Roman army, doesn't he?
Yes, he's the common thread. He basically outlives every single changeover. You're absolutely right. I was going to say that I think in Tacitus's Agricola, Agricola himself laments the quality of tribunes. These guys are kind of wastrels. I mean, they're out there to party and drink, and they're not. But for most of the time, they're probably not fighting anyway, right? So what is there to do? Just issue orders and keep the camp clean, polish your armor, and then when the times get tough and they're called to serve, you know.
That's probably, again, why, you know, in the second century, it's at least a tribune, the narrow-band tribune, Angusti Clavius. He has already had command of the Quinguinaria cohort for 2 to 4 years. So he should know something. It's probably still quite a young guy. And then they go on and do another military role. It might be different for the senatorial tribune. He might really be fresh behind the ears, upper class dude.
So Mike has been through formal training and a terrific experience base. Of course, the Romans, and I'm going to assume the Greeks, forgive me if I get that wrong, are basically learning from other guys, right? I mean, they're learning on the job. There's no school you go to become a tribune. There's no school you go to be a centurion. And of course, when you're talking about special operations, how the hell do you learn that? I guess it's that village of people who know how to throw stones. Well, they're very good at throwing stones, centurion. Pick five men and put them over there.
But I do want to point out, though, the fact that the system you're describing endures, and that basically you're talking about something that's occurring in the ancient world, and I'm standing here in 2021 going, oh, yeah, I totally get that. That gives me chills. And it also tells you something else, which is that it's a system that clearly works, right? Because the war is, believe me, if things don't work in war, certainly the military is conservative, things change slowly, there are a lot of bad ideas, but also people die when things are bad. So the fact that that system has persisted, and not just, by the way, in cultures, I don't want to say, I hate the term the Western world, west of the Dardanelles, right? But you see it in the East as well, right? East of the Dardanelles. So there's something in that persistence and the universality which speaks to effectiveness. I'm sure a lot of people will take issue with that, because especially people who've been in the military. But there really is something to that. I think that I recognize it as a modern veteran.
There's an interesting point in the late Roman Empire, so thinking about the Battle of Adrianople, where Sebastianus, before the Battle of Adrianople, is the only Roman commander to have any success against the Goths. He selects 300 men, ad lecto, the Latin equivalent of epilectoi or legades. He selects 300 men from each of his legions and uses them as a special force to defeat bands of ravaging Goths. And he succeeds. There's a huge revolt against Sebastianus at court that basically says he's a liar, he's untrustworthy. Unfortunately, he dies at the Battle of Adrianople, so he gets blamed, especially because he's a Western commander who's come from the West to the East. Secondly, there's the idea of how dare you not choose the rest of the troops, who basically have had their asses kicked for the last 2 years by the Goths. And so they're upset that they're not included in his selection. And it's an interesting response that he chooses these small amounts of units. The number 300 itself is really interesting because it goes all the way back to the Spartan 300 and Thermopylae 300, but there's 300s everywhere. It's always 300. Why? We don't know. Anyway, the interesting thing is that he selects these 300, and that gives us a sense of strength because he has 2,000 men. So he has seven legions, maybe. And the interesting thing is that because he selects those 300s, it's not regarded as a special force or a special operation. It's regarded as an insult to the remaining men he doesn't select, who then go on to fight the Battle of Adrianople and get destroyed by the Goths. So it's like, so you've taken the selection for skill, for ability, because he chooses them on their ability. The phrasing's fantastic in Ammianus. He chooses them for their ability to fight and to restore the army to manliness, whereas the rest of the soldiers were trained only for flight.
In other words, he picked the veterans and the people.
He picked the ones who knew, not the ones who were trained to run.
Trained only for flight. We were doing running practice.
Exactly. So that's not Ammianus, that's Zosimus. But so it's like, it's like the reverse of what we're talking about. It's not a special operation. It's an insult to the rest of us that you chose them in the first place. So there's kind of, and of course that ties into the idea that there's been a decline, the corruption, the army of the late 4th
century. It's funny, because that is actually an argument that's made for like World War II, when you have national conscription, and then you go and you pick the guys who are the most fit, best fighters, most aggressive. You take them out and you put them in like airborne division stuff, which are probably the first kind of, and the commandos, the first kinds of modern type of actual what we think of as special forces, and that has inevitably a detrimental effect on the guys who stay behind.
It's, that's very similar to Australia, going off topic here, but Australia in World War II, World War I, World War II, where you've got the AIF going overseas and whatnot, and then you have the Home Guard, I think I'm right in saying koalas, was the nickname given, basically deciding that they've got to be prepared for the home front in case of a Japanese invasion and whatnot, and then they're used in the islands and whatnot. But then you have the really uncomfortable situation at the end, towards the end of the war, where there's been a recall of the Australian forces from Europe, partially because they're saying, well, you know, why are these guys over there when they should be over here defending a home front? And they're brought back and come into collaboration with the guys who have been at home all the time. And you've got these two different attitudes of, you know, who's the special ones, really? The what special ones who have been over to Europe and whatnot? Or is it the guys who are, you know, have stuck here at home and are doing the proper job as such?
Well, there's an interesting, the Australian one's interesting because, of course, the troops who stayed at home were a militia to defend Australia. And then it said, oh, no, we're going to send you to Papua New Guinea. And it's like, we didn't agree to be sent overseas. So there's a near mutiny. And then when the Tobruk veterans come back, there's exactly that. But you get that with every, you know, the Navy versus the Army, like Tasmania. It's like half of it's governed by the Navy, half of it's governed by the Army, and they couldn't agree. And that, again, there's nothing different in the arms of different forces today.
The train bans in England in the English Civil War. They're fine until you make them move out of their hometown, and then it's the end of the world. And by the way, conflict between the horse and the foot in the Royalist Army. Like, this is, I love that these things are all tales as old as time. See, what Australians, you founded a country on the other side of the world, and all the crap came with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Ah, British imperialism.
I love it. Well, yes.
On that note, I'm sure I didn't think we actually, well, I think we touched on many of the things that were asked in the questions. I hope that people who did, Juan and Abram and Martin, feel like they got some answers.
Yeah, our apologies. We're having too much fun.
We had a question about recruiting. We answered that. We did a definition.
Yeah, we did pretty
specialized
good.
Training. Right. We touched on that.
Okay, well, we'll do good on that note. We did pretty good. Thank you very much, guys. Talk to you again soon.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.